greater power of art, by which I mean that the gap between the conception and the power of execution should be shortened. We should like that, and we should like, of course, longer time, if not indefinite time, which to go on knowing more and making more. Well, therefore, we make the elves immortal in a sense. I had to use immortal, but I didn't mean that they were eternally immortal, that merely that they are very longeval, and their longevity probably lasts as long as the inhabitability of the earth.
Professor Tom Shippey.
Tolkien said about his own work, the invention of languages is the foundation. The stories were made to provide a world for the languages rather than the reverse. Now, this is a really astonishing statement, and people have actually been very reluctant to believe him. They've assumed that he was joking or something. But we know he started off inventing the languages. We know that he has the Elvish greeting, Elen sila lumen omentielmo, may a star shine on the hour of our meeting. He wanted to find a world in which characters were likely to say that kind of thing.
What I'm doing now is to try and write in Elvish, which I'm saying my writing is very inferior to the Elv. Their standard greeting when meeting, a star shines upon our meeting. Oh, Lord. I made a mistake, didn't I? And that stands for Elen Sila Lumen Omenti Elvo. I wouldn't mind other people knowing it and enjoying it, but I didn't really want to, like some people who've been equally inventive in language, have doubtless want to make cults and have people all speaking it together. I don't desire to go and have afternoons talking Elvish to chaps.
Yet that is precisely what many of Tolkien's most ardent fans now do.
I'll bereth gilthoniel, silivren pennamiriel o menelaglar elenath, na chaered palandiriel o menelaglar elenath, fanwylos, le linnachon, nefai ar si, nefai ar oam.
When you know Elvish, yes, there are all sort of linguistic puns, linguistic jokes that only people who can, for example, read Elvish or know the etymology of a particular word can really appreciate all the ramifications.
One of the titles that Aragorn uses in his letter to Samwise is Hir Imbair Anoy, which means Lord of Western Lands.
That's right.
And obviously, Anoy means Western. But it's lands, byr,
in the plural.
Dir avo saifa gwaihinar englid erid agenaid, dim tumledin hin nebracha, yuch mefail maifon nagraddaid, damro dihanach darachden.
Tolkien's imagination even stretched to ideas about elven music. When the composer Donald Swan made settings for the verses in The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien himself contributed the tune for the farewell, which the Lady Galadriel sings as Frodo and the Fellowship set out from the golden wood of Lothlorien on their perilous journey. The song begins, "Ah, like gold fall the leaves in the wind, long years numberless as the wings of trees. The long years have passed, like swift draughts of the sweet mead in lofty halls beyond the west."
Ai, lauriel am tarlassi surinen, jeni un ottime verammar allaron, jeni velindar juldar avanien, mi oromar delisse miru vorreva. Andure pella vardo tellumar nul vini jassam tintilari ellini o maireo aeretari lirine. Simani julmanin en quantuva.
Once again, the story was told as it was written, this time to Tolkien's friends, the Inklings. Professor Robert Giddings.
I think it's a very devout book at one level. It's a book about Tolkien's fundamental beliefs about religion, about human society, about human destiny. But at another level, it was a book written to please the Inklings. C.S. Lewis said to Tolkien once, "You know, Tollers, there aren't enough books of the kind that we enjoy. We'll have to write some." I think Tolkien was trying to satisfy particular kinds of literary appetites. For a start, the fondness for George MacDonald, which a lot of the Inklings had, their love of The Wind and the Willows, their obsession with the kind of fiction that all middle-class and upper-class schoolboys of their generation enjoyed, like Rider Haggard, like John Buchan, like Lorna Doone. And I believe that all these elements are demonstrably present in The Lord of the Rings, and it's sometimes Tolkien's treatment of the source material in The Lord which makes it funny, because he's taking the mic out of King Solomon's Mines and 39 Steps at times. If you take, for example, the world conspiracy story, when Gandalf explains to Frodo the conspiracy to take over Middle-earth, I'm sure that is an echo, probably not an echo, probably a deliberate and rather witty imitation of the 39 Steps. After all, where do the ring bearers flee to? They go to Buckland. Now, isn't that a joke on Buchan? And Strider, isn't that a variant of Scudder? It's Scudder in 39 Steps. If you remember, the wicked gang that chase Frodo and company in The Lord of the Rings are called the Black Riders. The wicked gang in the 39 Steps are the Black Stone. He was really obsessed with language and the possibility of language and the possibility of words. C.S. Lewis, again, is a good witness. He says that Tolkien had been inside language, that language played the part in Tolkien's imagination and sensibility that music does in other people's. And The Lord of the Rings, I think once you learn how to read it, is full of these clues.
Whatever interpretation you put on Tolkien's story, it ultimately assumes the scale of an epic, as the hobbits, Frodo and Sam, wearily pursue their long and dangerous road through Middle-earth, drawing ever nearer to the fires of Mount Doom, where the ring at last might perhaps be destroyed. Alan Lee.
The closer they get to Mordor, to the realm of Sauron, the more colossal and dark and huge and forbidding the towers and fortresses and dungeons and really set against the diminutive size of the heroes as they're whittled down to just the two of them, just Frodo and Sam making their way across this vast landscape towards this huge volcano. It just makes the odds against them so vast.
No taste of food, no feel of water, no sound of wind, no memory of grass or flower. No image of moon or star are left to me. I am naked in the dark, Sam, and there is no veil between me and the Wheel of Fire. I begin to see it even with my waking eyes, and all else fades.
The New Hobbit took a good deal of writing and a fair amount of linguistic gymnastics, beginning with the invention of a plethora of names.
I always, in the writing, always start with a name. Give me a name and it produces a story, not the other way about, normally. In the first test, it has to sound a nice name to me, even if I don't know what it means.
Occasionally, names which sounded right in one language proved to be completely wrong when they were subsequently translated into one of the other languages of Middle-earth.
But then you, of course, come across this unfortunate fact that if it doesn't always happen that if you work that those same elements with the same meaning into a name, it doesn't always come out as a nice name, in spite of that. So then you have to give them another name or do something about it. Yes, it's a minor technical craft, actually.
Some names, of course, really needed to sound anything but nice in any language, especially orc names such as Shagrat, Gorbag, or Ugluk.
You wouldn't like think much of a chap called Ugluk, could you? No. My things, I did try to use the languages which I did understand, tried to use them to characterise. Also, of course, gives me great pleasure.
Tolkien had begun The Lord of the Rings in 1937. It was all of 12 years before he reached the final chapters.
1949, I think. I actually wept at the Field of Cormallin, where, of course, the tears come easier, I think, at the good denouement.
pale, Frodo.
Sam.
Well, if that isn't the crown of all. Strider! Or I'm still asleep.
Yes, Strider. It is a long way, is it not, from Bree, where you did not like the look of me. A long way for all of us. But yours has been the darkest road. I bend my knee in acknowledgement of that.
No, Strider. You must not bow, not to us.
Come. You shall sit upon my throne. There. Praise them with great praise.
Praise them! Praise them!
But then, of course, it's a tremendous revision. I typed the whole of that work out twice, and lots of it many times, on a bed in an attic. Well, they couldn't afford the, of course, the typing. There were some mistakes still. And also, some frightful mistakes in grammar from a professor of English language, a little rather shocking. There was one where I used bestrode as the past passive of bestride. There's a lot of things like that, yeah. Yes, there are some. And, of course, dwarves originally mistake in grammar, of course. I've tried to cover it up, but it's just purely the fact that I have a tendency to increase the number of these vestigial approvals, which is a change of consonant, like leaf leaves. My tendency is to make more of them than are now standard. And I really thought dwarves, why not?
It was in 1952 that Tolkien's publishers finally received the finished manuscript of The Lord of the Rings. Stanley Unwin was abroad at the time, so his son Rainer, who was now working for the firm, made some calculations and found that publication of such a large work, it was 1,000 pages long, was going to be a costly exercise.
I wrote to my father, who was on a Far Eastern tour, saying, I think it's a work of genius. I think it's going to lose us £1,000. And my father wrote one of those marvellous letters that prove he's right, whichever way it goes, which said, if you believe this to be a work of genius, then you may lose £1,000. And so it was a decision made, we made a contract and we published.
For ease of publishing, the book was divided into three volumes, the first of which, The Fellowship of the Ring, appeared in August 1954. Professor Robert Giddings on the public reception for Tolkien's book.
In a way, the reception of The Lord of the Rings was superbly stage-managed and orchestrated by his publishers and by the mandarins of the metropolitan media. He got very good press in the quality papers, Bernard Levin, and people went over the top. And this was followed by the most astounding and impressive silence from British academies.
Indeed, and Tolkien's fellow academics at Oxford were for the most part politely uninterested, wondering how a work of fantasy could have taken almost a decade and a half to reach publication.
I don't feel any guilt complex about The Lord of the Rings, as many people have said. Now we know what you've wasted the last 14 years upon, you can now get on and complete some of those professional tasks which you've neglected and so on.
Nevertheless, several important literary figures praised the book. C.S. Lewis described it as being like lightning from a clear sky. Naomi Mitchison compared Tolkien to Thomas Malory, the chronicler of the Arthurian legends, and poet Richard Hughes likened its imaginative scope to that of Edmund Spenser's The Faerie Queen. Dr. John Carey.
Naturally, everyone will agree that it's remarkable that an imaginative and creative work of this scope and bulk should be forthcoming from a professor of Anglo-Saxon, or any other professor for that matter. How many academics, it's rightly asked, could manage anything approaching the amplitude and the variety of The Lord of the Rings? I certainly don't want to dissent from that kind of appreciation. What I do feel, though, is that the claims some critics have made for the book and the comparisons they've initiated are extravagant and misdirected, and can only do the book a disservice in the long run by raising expectations to a level which the book itself, I feel, is far from being able to justify. Richard Hughes, for instance, likens The Lord of the Rings to Spenser's Faery Queen, and wants that sort of comparison can be made and becomes current, then the book's bound to be taken up, as indeed it is being taken up, by the academic industry and treated to the usual deadening routine of explication and exegesis and source study. What I do want to criticise is the trend that puts The Lord of the Rings and The Faerie Queen on the same level or in the same bracket. The Faerie Queen is a great work of literature, and The Lord of the Rings is a children's book. Now, I know that thousands of adults read it, but that's neither here nor there. Thousands of adults read comic strips.
But The Lord of the Rings is not a comic strip, nor, most people would argue, is it a book for children. Dr. Carey disagrees.
What marks The Lord of the Rings as a children's book is that its morality is simplified in the way morality has to be for children, and it discreetly leaves out, as children's books generally do, that whole area of adult life and adult fantasy, for it is much of the time a work of fantasy, which involves eroticism and sexuality and sensuous experience. Now, The Faerie Queen, of course, explores and illustrates that particular realm with a richness almost unparalleled in English literature, whereas in The Lord of the Rings it's restricted and, so to speak, censured for the sake of childish readers. There are hardly any women in The Lord of the Rings at all, a few untouchably pure princesses, and a female spider called Shelob is about the sum of it, I think.
When Tolkien himself had been asked several years earlier about the absence of sex in his books, he replied briefly,
"But after all, these are wars and a terrible expedition to the North Pole, so to speak."
Except, of course, that there's about as much similarity between Mount Doom and the North Pole as there is between The Lord of the Rings and a children's book. Unless, of course, you agree with Dr. John Carey.
The fact that it's a children's book doesn't, you may say, prevent its being great literature. Quite right. Aren't The Wind in the Willows and Winnie the Pooh and Alice in Wonderland great in their way, though they are for children? Yes, I think they are great. But I'd argue that their style and their wit are greatly superior to The Lord of the Rings, which indeed hasn't any wit at all. It has some attempts at humour, though I personally find them rather painful. The adventure yarn style, of course, isn't its only stylistic level. There's also a good deal of what one can only compare, if one compares it with anything, with Enid Blyton. This sort of thing, for instance. Bag End began to be busy. Some of Frodo's friends came to stay and help him with the packing. There was Fredegar Bolger and Folko Boffin, and of course his special friends Pippin Took and Merry Brandybuck. Between them they turned the whole place upside down. Well, the way the trite phrases come trickling out there, his special friends, they turned the whole place upside down, seems to me irresistibly reminiscent of Enid Blyton, which may, of course, explain why The Lord of the Rings sells so well. Being like Enid Blyton is much more likely to make you a bestseller than being like The Faerie Queen.
An interesting choice of extract, plucked, as it happens, from page 76 of The Fellowship of the Ring. Rainer Unwin.
I do think that the first 100 pages of The Lord of the Rings is a testing event, because if you can take that and get hooked, you can go on, and you won't stop. If you can't take that first 100 pages, which is a little bit twee at times, I find, anyway, there are a sort of 11-1st birthday parties and so on, it really does test you a little bit.
Well, I've called you together for a purpose. Indeed, for three purposes. First of all, to tell you that I'm immensely fond of you all, and that 11 years is too short a time to live among such excellent and admirable hobbies. I don't know half of you as well as I should like, and I like less than half of you as well as you deserve. And secondly, I have called you all together to celebrate my birthday. Or I should say, our birthday, for it is, of course, also the birthday of my nephew and heir, Frodo. He comes of age and comes into his inheritance today.
Didn't hear that, Elfo. mean inheritance?
I don't know, Lobelia, but I don't like the sound of it at all.
Together, our years total 144. Your numbers were chosen to fit this remarkable total. One gross, if I may use the expression.
One gross, indeed.
Nasty, vulgar expression.
Thirdly and finally, I wish to make an announcement. I regret to announce that although, as I said, 71 years is far too short a time to spend among you, this is the end. I'm going. I'm leaving. Now. Goodbye.
Where did he go?
He vanished.
Oh, 1 minute he was there, and
then
he's gone.
Yeah, how did he do it?
Did anyone see what happened?
How extremely bad-mannered.
He's mad. I always said so, mad.
The Lord of the Rings had its critics from the moment it was published. Edmund Wilson, for example, dismissed it as long-winded balderdash, and Tolkien was particularly irritated by the criticism of another reviewer.
How one reviewer explained it. He said it was written by a man who's never reached puberty and knows nothing about women except for a schoolboy. And all the good guys come home like happy boys, safe from the war.
While one critic complained that the book lacked human discrimination and depth, another bemoaned its dearth of religious spirit. A devout Catholic, Tolkien would later defend the absence of traditional gods in The Lord of the Rings.
The man of the 20th century must, of course, see that you must have, whether he believes them or not, you must have gods in a story of this kind. But he can't make himself believe in gods like Thor and Odin, Aphrodite, Zeus, and that kind of thing. I couldn't possibly construct a mythology which had Olympus or Asgard in it, on the terms in which the people who worshipped those gods believed. God is supreme, the creator, outside, transcendent. But the place of the gods is taken. So well taken, I think, that it really makes no difference to the ordinary reader. It's taken by the angelic spirits created by God, but created before the particular time sequence which we call the world, which is called in their language Ea, that which is, that which now exists. Those are the valor, the power.
Although The Lord of the Rings contains no specific reference to the God of the Christian faith, the story does have an archetypal happy ending that was inspired by Tolkien's religious beliefs. Tolkien commentators Tom Shippey and first, Valentine Cunningham.
He even, of course, invented a word for it in his lecture on fairy tales. He talked about the U catastrophe, the good ending, which he saw as part of the Christian story and as part of the essence of fairy stories. It is also the pattern of the Victorian novel. And of course it's very interesting that Tolkien got to this sense of Christian resolution after having lived through the First World War. Tolkien clearly trying to recreate that sense of the tight-lipped hero and of the battle in which we won't dwell too much on the individual sufferings of the warriors in question. The Wilfred Owen, Siegfried Sassoon kind of stuff need not have been written as far as Tolkien's heroic is concerned.
If I can cut in, I think there are some First World War bits quite obvious in The Lord of the Rings, and one of them is very strong and very moving, and that, I think, is the passage through the Dead Marshes, when Frodo and Gollum and Sam are plodding through this dreadful cratered slag heap, and at the bottom of the slag heap, in the mud, they keep seeing the rotting faces.
What's all this, Gollum? What are these lights?
Yes, yes, lights this is.
They're all round us now.
Yes, they are all round us. The tricksy lights. Candles of corpses.
Yes, yes.
Don't you heed them? Don't look. Don't follow them.
Where's Master?
Huh? Mr. Frodo. Mr. Frodo. Mr. Frodo, don't look at them. Gollum says we mustn't. Let's keep up with him and get out of this cursed place as quick as we can, if we can.
All right, Sam. I'm coming, I'm coming.
What is it, Mr. Frodo? What did you see?
Dead things, dead faces in the water. Dead faces.
The dead marshes. Yes, yes, that's the name. You shouldn't look in when the candles are lit, silly master.
Who are they? What are they?
Don't know. They lie in all the pools. Pale faces. Deep, deep under the dark water. Saw them. Grim faces. And evil. And noble faces. And sad. Many faces, proud and fair, with weeds in their silver hair, but all foul, all rotting, all dead.
Yes. Yes.
All dead.
All rotten.
Another contemporary critic of The Lord of the Rings described Tolkien's literary style as veering from pre-Raphaelite to boy's own paper. John Carey again.
Another style, besides the Blightonesque and the lad's adventure yarn, another style that's heavily drawn on is that of 19th century historical romance. People say things like, I should like a bite and sup, or let us now laugh and be glad. When they wash their hands, they don't wash them, they're said to be laving them, laving their hands in basins. And they're very free with words like lo and verily, and they say delve for dig and deem for think and so on. And in the would-be sublime bits, inversions, sort of poetic inversions, regularly used in order to introduce a faintly biblical flavour.
It is the language of The Lord of the Rings that has most sharply divided Tolkien's critics. Valentine Cunningham.
I find Lord of the Rings extremely simple. After all, a lot of his sentences are very short. Apart from the violence, which does mightily enliven it, the battles, the fights, and the meals, that kind of thing. On the whole, it is very flat writing, enlivened only by these moments, it seems to me, where Tolkien sinks a little philological well and pulls up a bucket full of lexicographer's juice.
Tom Shippey.
The reason I read it is I think there's a great deal of philological wisdom in it. And philology, I think, you see, is not the same as linguistics, it's not the same as literature, but it is some combination of those two. But it also takes in real things. If I can give one example, the first thing you're told about the riders of Rohan is that they live on the East Emnet, and they also live on the West Emnet. And you ask yourself, what is an Emnet? And you start looking up the answers to that, and you find it's a village in Norfolk, Emnet. It's also a word derived from Old English Even Yemeth, even meadow. And what it is the English word for steppe or prairie. You notice that in English we don't have a word for steppe or prairie because we haven't got any. But, Tolkien knew quite well, the English had emigrated, they'd come to this country. Many of their cousins turned the other way. They went to Russia. They became Goths. They ended up as Lombards. If they had survived, what would they have been like, he asked himself. And the answer is the riders of the Mark, living on the Emnet.
If Tolkien's fictional writing sprang from his linguistic and literary studies, there was also a corresponding influence in the opposite direction. Humphrey Carpenter.
It's equally interesting to look at the academic work and find something of the air of The Lord of the Rings in that. I mean, in his celebrated lecture on Beowulf, The Monsters and the Critics, there's a marvellous passage where he has an allegory within this very academic lecture in which he talks about the poem as a tower which was built by a man out of old stones. Then his friends coming along saw that the stones had belonged to an older building, so they pushed the tower over to look for carvings or to find out where the building material had come from or even to see if there was coal beneath the site. And, you know, made remarks like, what an odd fellow he was, imagining his using these old stones just to build a nonsensical tower. Why didn't he do this or that or the other? And then, says Tolkien, but from the top of that tower, the man had been able to look out upon the sea.
There is, it has to be said, a tightly structured hierarchy to Middle-earth. However, although in The Lord of the Rings the authority of kings and rulers is passed down the bloodlines from generation to generation, Tolkien had his doubts about similar hierarchies in the real world.
I don't know about that. No, it's a very potent story-making and emotive thing, but how far one's said is really work better than any other system in looking at the history of the world, one doubts pretty much. It's never been worse, at any rate, than the struggle for power that always ensues when you haven't got some line of descent which can't be questioned.
In the end, he clung to a concept of a society in which everyone knew their place.
I'm rather wedded to those kind of loyalties because I think, contrary to most people, I think that touching your cap to the squire may be damn bad for the squire, but it's damn good for you.
What is also undeniable is that the book suggests that the greatest fear that can face any society is the destructive force of industrialisation. Maybe this isn't so surprising when one remembers that Tolkien lived through a time during which the world underwent many dramatic changes.
Well, the person of my age, you see, is exactly the kind of person who's lived through one of the most quickly changing periods of known to history. And that the world is a totally different place now, at a speed. Everybody feels that. Anybody who lives over 70 begins to feel that all through history. You can see that they do.
It's pretty clear that the great anathema in The Lord of the Rings is 20th century industrial society, industrialism. Saruman, you'll remember, turns Isengard into an urban landscape. That's the sort of thing wicked people do, we gather. Trees are chopped down, roads paved with stone flags, and there are smithies and furnaces where wheels revolve and hammers thud. And this place is, in fact, a pale imitation of the really evil spot in the book, Mordor, an industrial landscape complete with furnaces and chimneys and slag heaps, or, as they're called, the vomit of the maggot folk of Mordor. To slaughter the sort of person who lives in such surroundings is, we gather, a perfectly correct and, indeed, enjoyable pastime. Let loose among the orcs, we read, the riders of Rohan sang as they slew, for the joy of battle was on them. The orcs and other industrial workers are racially inferior. They have, we're told, swart faces and great clumsy limbs, and they suffer uniformly from body odour. The ruffianly immigrants who pour into the shire from the south are plainly of an inferior type too, and they have menacing socialistic doctrines. The squint-eyed, ill-favoured fellow who's their spokesman warns that if room isn't found for them, they'll find it for themselves. They've a right to live same as other folk, he says. Now, by contrast, the hobbits are gentlemen. A very nice, well-spoken, gentle hobbit, Bilbo's called. They're keen on genealogy, titles and ceremony, and they're waited on by respectful servants like Sam Gamgee, Frodo's Batman, who's simple-minded, inferior and touchingly loyal. The attitude towards industrialism, then, which the book inculcates, is that industry is something that people create out of spite. Well, this is what I mean when I say that the book's morality is simplified and childish.
Which view prompted Tolkien's friend Donald Swan to this response.
Tolkien may have been reactionary, but he had been brought up in a structured society. He was a Catholic, where there are priests and people in different categories. He was a professor, and his students were another category, though he honoured them all. He fought in a war where there were officers and other ranks. His epic contains great men and little men, kings and commoners, and also vile enemies who had to be slain before good could triumph. All that Tolkien accepted unreservedly, as have epic writers before him. I think The Lord of the Rings will be loved henceforth by people who suspect and fear industrial technology and are afraid that it may destroy us. Since the book was written, the number of these people, reasonable people in my estimation, has greatly increased.
Whatever the criticisms, The Fellowship of the Ring and the subsequent volumes The Two Towers and The Return of the King sold well enough to suggest that Rainer Unwin's initial investment had not been as risky as had first been thought.
We began not to think of losing £1,000, but perhaps of making £1,000. But it was on this sort of scale.
Then suddenly it took off, much to Tolkien's surprise.
Nobody been more staggered, you know? Unless it was possibly Sir Stanley Unwin. I was up at Stanley Unwin's birthday celebration, and a bookseller came up to me. Such fervor, he said that I'd While he got copied, it sold so well, it practically kept him going for a while. Well, he gets his guinea off the set, you see.
The Lord of the Rings was discovered by the Americans, suitably endorsed, by the way, by Arthur C. Clarke. Tolkien societies were formed on both sides of the Atlantic, and the book was embraced by the hippie generation. There was even a notorious club called Middle Earth, where patrons found unexpected similarities between the journey in the book and a trip on acid. Author Jenny Fabian.
There are the cracks of doom, which we've all seen on acid trips, especially when the wallpaper's peeling. And consequently, the club Middle Earth actually had a similar feel to it, with the black walls and everything. And a lot of people took their acid down there because they felt they were in another world.
Those high priests of the 60s, the Beatles, even toyed with the idea of making a film based on the books. The group's biographer, Bill Harry.
John was supposed to be Gollum, you know, this wicked, mischievous, malevolent creature which suited John's dark side and his nature. And turned out that Paul would have been Frodo, you know, this sort of hobbit which goes on these big adventures. And Ringo was to be Sam Ganji, his faithful servant, you know, his ever faithful manservant and that. And, of course, George Harrison was to be Gandalf, the wizard. And, of course, at the time, this suited their personalities ideally.
It was all a long, wild way from the ordered and quietly respectable life of the average Oxford don. With the book's growing popularity came the first attempts to work out what it meant. Clearly, of course, it was a picture of the eternal struggle between good and evil.
Well, that's, I suppose, an actual conscious reaction from a war, from the stuff that I was brought up in a war to end wars, which I didn't believe in at the time, and believe in less now.
Not surprisingly, perhaps, the author was constantly being asked what the ring itself symbolised.
I have not brought you here to be instructed by you, but to give you a choice.
What choice do you speak of, Saruman?
The elder days are gone. The middle days are passing, younger days are beginning. The time of the elves is over, but our time is ahead. The world of men which we must rule. But we must have power. Power to order all things as we will, for that good which only the wise can see. Listen, Gandalf, my old friend and helper. I said we, for we it may be if you join with me. A new power is rising. Against it the old allies and policies will not avail us at all. This, then, is the choice before you, before us. We may join with that power. It would be wise, Gandalf.
How could it ever be wise to join with Sauron, our enemy?
There is hope that way. His victory is at hand, and there will be rich reward for those who aided it.
Yes, Saruman, I have heard speeches of this kind before, but only in the mouths of emissaries sent from Mordor to deceive the ignorant. I cannot think that you brought me so far only to weary my ears.
Well, I see that this wise course does not commend itself to you. Not yet. Not if some better way can be contrived.
What better way?
The ruling ring? And why not, Gandalf? Why not? The power would pass to us if we could but command it.
Saruman, only one hand at a time can wield the one ring, and you know that well. So don't trouble to say we.
I have many eyes in my service, Gandalf, and I believe that you know where this precious thing now lies. Well, is it not so?
Now that I learn your mind, I will not even give you news of it.
You are a fool.
Well, your choices are, it seems, to submit to Sauron or to submit to you. I will take neither. Have you others to offer?
Yes. The third choice is to stay here. You shall contemplate your folly from the highest pinnacle of the Tower of Orthanc. Until the end.
Until what end?
Until you reveal to me where the One Ring may be found. Or until it is found in spite of you.
Is the book to be considered as an allegory?
No. I just like allegory whenever I smell it.
That's what he said. But still they went on asking.
There is a temptation to read into the book a kind of allegory of the H-bomb. What is said somewhere in the book is that the One Ring is a power so enormous that even if a good man were to use it against a bad, it would corrupt the good man.
But that is a thing which other people have arrived, other views other people arrived at long before H-bomb was invented. Also, I may say that I began building the stories in which of the Dark Lord when I was an undergraduate. They were already in advanced stage during the First War. The H-bomb hadn't been heard of.
No wonder Ronald Tolkien found it all a bit confusing. Rainer Unwin.
He was confused by the extraordinary reaction that he got, particularly from America, but increasingly from England as well. It wasn't what he wanted or expected, or that he conceived his book as arousing. When he began to get telephone calls in the middle of the night from America, from people who didn't know there was a time difference in any way, were fairly high on drugs, asking him ridiculous questions in the middle of the night, or when people came and trampled on his roses in his house in Sandfield Road to take photographs of him eating breakfast through the window, he began to feel irritated, infringed upon. He hated it, basically.
To help Tolkien cope with his ever-growing correspondence, the publishers provided him with secretarial assistance in the person of Joy Hill.
It was part of my job to have his mail and, where necessary, give him the letters which were personal. And indeed, he saw a lot of the fan mail, but he obviously couldn't answer them all because sometimes we average between 200 or 300 a week. What was so striking was that his interest in the various letters that came. Now, these were very diverse. Royalty wrote, presidents' daughters, prisoners in jail, people in Broadmoor, mothers with sons on drugs, social workers who had no life outside their work and were being depressed by their work. And he took a great interest in the underdog. And this is particularly so with one person who was in an institution and was having nightmares as a result of reading The Lord of the Rings. And I always, as a precaution, had to check up with the doctor or the ward sister in these cases, because sometimes you've got people who write to him and were so ill that the next day they would forget they'd ever written. But in this particular case, he wrote to the person in question and continued to do so, and she progressed, and he explained to her that there was no need to be frightened and gave reasons why. And every Christmas he kept saying, I've had a Christmas card from Miss X. And the same was true of a prisoner in jail who, when his cell door was locked at night, just lived for reading The Lord of the Rings and losing himself in that book. And also true of a lady of 80 in a London basement flat who was going blind. Her one highlight of the day was when her neighbour came in and read her the next few pages of The Lord of the Rings.
Many of those who wrote to Tolkien did so in order to tell him what they liked and didn't like about his book, though their views were often as polarised as those of the professional critics.
I once said, and I think it's roughly true, that if I was to listen to my correspondence, every part of The Lord of the Rings is a failure or its only weakness. On the other hand, there's another list which every part of it is particular strength.
Tolkien retired in 1959. And 9 years later, he and Edith left Oxford for a bungalow near the English seaside town of Bournemouth. That's where he lived until Edith's death in 1971, when he returned to Oxford, living in rooms belonging to Merton College, where he was looked after by a college scout, Charlie Carr.
He'd got a system. I mean, it was breakfast at 9 o'clock in the morning, which I think only from about two occasions all the time that he was here, this never differed. It was always 9 o'clock. He was a very, as I say, a man with a great system. Even down to his taxi for church on Sunday, it was always at 10:20, and that was it. He was always ready for it, just waiting, actually, dressed, waiting. And, of course, this Sunday morning was to St Anthony's Church at Headley Way, Headington, and after that, to the cemetery at Wolvercote, to his wife's grave, and then back home for lunch.
Tolkien received various academic accolades. an honorary degree from Edinburgh University, an honorary doctorate of letters from Oxford, and the CBE. And all the time he continued to work away at the Silmarillion, which George Allen and Unwin, by the way, now wanted to publish. From time to time, he reflected also on the nature of fame. How might he be remembered, one interviewer asked him. Would it be for his academic work?
The last part of my work was actually done, as I now discover, to my great pleasure, because I was always a diffident lecturer. I had never any idea whether I was having any effect or not. And it's pleasant in later years to discover that I must have had quite a considerable effect through the form of lectures. I was an assiduous lecturer, which is partly why I was not an assiduous writer. I took a great deal of trouble over lectures, lectured a great deal more than my statutes demanded on lots of different subjects.
Would he be remembered then for something else?
If I remember at all, it would be by the Lord of the Rings, I'd take it. I wouldn't mind the other being remembered, but I am conscious that they're small and not very important. Won't it be rather like the case of Longfellow, won't it? People remember Longfellow wrote Hiawatha and perhaps one or two other things. They quite forget he was a professor of modern languages.
He also understood with a new clarity the underlying theme to his epic tale.
If you really come down to any large story that interests people, can hold them their attention for a considerable time, or make the stories, practically always a human story, practically always about one thing, aren't they? Death. The inevitability of death. All men must die, but for every man his death is an accident, and even if he knows it and consents to it, an unjustifiable violation. Well, you may agree with the words or not, but those are the key spring of the Lord of the Rings.
Perhaps then, like Bilbo in The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien's thoughts began to turn to the finality of death. Maybe he recalled the words of a poem that he had earlier given to Bilbo to speak. Donald Swann had set it to music, and the song had first been performed in 1966 at Ronald and Edith's golden wedding anniversary.
I sit beside the fire and think of all that I have seen, of meadow flowers and butterflies in summers that have been, of yellow leaves and gossamer in autumns that there were, with morning mist and silver sun and wind upon my hair. Sit beside the fire and think of people long ago, and people who will see a world that I shall never know. But all the while I sit and think of times that were before, I listen for returning feet and voices at the door.
Now it was only a few years later, but Edith was gone, and even though his work was still far from complete, his own life was drawing to a close. Humphrey Carpenter.
This is the garage of the last house that Tolkien lived in Oxford, and he took this space over as an extra study. I came here in 1967 to meet him, and the place had become a kind of living Middle-earth. He was still writing his books in here. Along the wall here, there were maps of Middle-earth, Frodo's journey from the Shire across to Mordor. Over here, there were files stacked along the floor and rickety bookcases and so on. There was a big table in the middle covered with papers. And, of course, there was Tolkien himself, who was talking absolutely at top speed about what was in his mind at the moment. He was still labouring at the Silmarillion 50 years after beginning it.
Some of those who knew Tolkien well have suggested that he didn't really want to finish the Silmarillion, that to have finished it would, in a sense, have been to have finished his life. But others disagree, believing that whilst he wanted to finish the work, it was just too huge a task, and that he was just too tired. Eventually, it would fall to his younger son, Christopher, to complete the Silmarillion for publication. Meanwhile, there was no doubting that Tolkien had already created a work of enduring literary importance. Rainer Unwin.
His storytelling is, I think, unparalleled in this century. It is that that brings in the non-literary establishment. The literary establishment has never really been at all at ease with Tolkien, and still isn't. It only just goes to show the literary establishment is one thing, and people who read books are another.
Tolkien's friend, Father Gervase Matthew.
When I look back on him, he seems an odd figure for the 20th century. He was essentially Malory, and he looked at the Tolkien world as the notes of the world of Malory. It stands on its own. It has its own life. One can almost hear the leaves rustling. That, of course, was because Tolkien heard them. It had been his own world ever since he was a small boy. He had lived in it and grown in it. And all his knowledge as a scholar, his outstanding skill in philology, his expertise, all was poured out into that world and the study of its languages and of its individuals. And I think that men looking back on our century may see it as essentially a Tolkien phase, like a Malory phase.
Humphrey Carpenter.
He said he wanted to create a mythology for England. I don't think he did exactly that, but I think he rediscovered kinds of narrative, the power of the saga and of the adventure story, which had been lost from 20th century English fiction. It's extraordinary to think that these books, which began life as stories he told to his own children, have proved so full of meaning for so many different kinds of people, and they will undoubtedly prove to be key books when we look back at the 20th century.
John Ronald Reuel Tolkien died on September the 2nd, 1973. He was buried with Edith, and their gravestone carries, in addition to their own names, those of Beren and Luthien, the lovers in Tolkien's legend who were faithful to death and beyond. With his passing, Tolkien truly left this world the richer, richer for having given us the opportunity to be transported into those strange, beautiful, and dangerous other worlds of his extraordinary imagination.
Sam?
Oh, Mr. Frodo, I thought you were going to enjoy the Shire for years and years after all you've done.
So I thought too once. But I have been too deeply hurt, Sam. I tried to save the Shire, and it has been saved. But not for me. It must often be so, Sam. When things are in danger, someone has to give them up, lose them, so that others may keep them. But you... you are my heir. All that I had and might have had, I leave to you, Sam. Mm-hmm. You will be the most famous gardener in all history. Mm. And you will read things out of the Red Book and keep alive the memory of the age that is gone so that people will remember the great danger and so love their beloved land all the more. And that will keep you as busy and as happy as anyone can be. Mm. As long as your part of the story goes on.
Mr. Frodo, my dear.
Now, go in peace. I will not say, do not weep. For not all tears are an evil.
Then the ring bearers went aboard the ship. The sails were drawn up, and the wind blew. And slowly, the ship slipped away down the long grey firth, and the light of the glass of Galadriel that Frodo bore glimmered and was lost. And the ship went out into the high sea and passed on into the west.
In the extracts from the BBC's serialisation of The Lord of the Rings, dramatised by Brian Sibley and Michael Bakewell, the part of Frodo was played by Ian Holm, Gandalf by Michael Horden, Aragorn by Robert Stevens, Bilbo by John LeMessurier, and Gollum by Peter Woodthorpe. With Sam, Bill Nighy, Merry, Richard O'Callaghan, Pippin, John McAndrew, Elrond, Hugh Dixon, Saruman, Peter Howell, and Treebeard, Stephen Thorne. The narrator was Gerard Murphy. The music was composed and conducted by Stephen Oliver, and the singers were David James and Matthew Vine, with the new chamber soloists. The directors were Jane Morgan and Penny Lester. J.R.R. Tolkien, An Audio Portrait, was written and presented by Brian Sibley, researched and produced by Peter Hutchings, and is published on audio by BBC Worldwide.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.